This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Neat Little Monsters, the animal companion in speculative fiction.
Now, this episode was a combined effort.
since effort being the operative word.
Both of us are not feeling very well today, and so our imaginations weren't stretching that far, so Jules was like, what should we do the episode on? And I just went, cats! And Jules went, we can't just do an episode on cats. And I maintain that we can do an episode about cats, so in future there will be an entire episode all about cats. But Jules was a little bit more sensible and suggested we kind of sort of widen the spectrum a little bit and bring in other animal companions as well.
I mean, episode will still contain cats, most likely.
Yes, I mean, it'd be difficult not to talk about cats. But, I am going to have a whole episode about cats. Mark my words. I will have it. I will. Now, the interesting thing about animal companions is it all started with something very odd, whereby human beings decided that it was a good idea to keep something which probably wanted to kill them.
You're talking about cross-species roommates.
Yes. I'm talking about way back when there were wolves. You know, it wasn't dogs, they were wolves. And there was a human being who looked at this wolf and thought, you know what? I'ma put a collar on that. Yeah. And that's where it all started.
I mean, it probably goes back even slightly further than that, in the fact that humans, early humans, most likely developed their hunting techniques by studying predatory animals and adapting those predatory animals' techniques to something that had opposable thumbs.
Yes.
And wolves, understandably, are both predators and they are carrion eaters. So anyone who hunted something, you know, big enough that they could not carry the whole thing off in one go. So you're talking like the Megaroceros and the mammoth and things like that. That's an easy meal for a predator. And they probably noticed that, you know, they set up this sort of unwitting symbiotic relationship whereby a small wolf pack would probably sort of trail hunters. And
Is either one of the trunters? Either one of the hunters would get injured and would be an easy meal, or whatever they hunted might easily be nabbed.
Yeah, and sometimes you can, you know, they'd injure an animal, but not enough to bring it down. But that makes it a really, really easy kill for, say, a wolf pack.
Yeah.
Wolf packs tend to only be successful 1 in every 10 hunts.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and obviously they've changed, and what we know about wolves has changed now that we've stopped hunting them almost to extinction, so that could be subject to a little bit of revision. But the other aspect, obviously, you bring in is the whole sort of, we developed basically what seems to be a biological imperative for empathy.
Yeah.
So it would be easy for us to see an injured young animal and perhaps pity it and take it in and try and look after it. And then you suddenly have this whole new dynamic where you have an animal being treated like it's part of the tribe.
Yeah. And actually responding to that.
And you develop new relationships that way. And then I suppose they discovered that different species of animals could live together if they're introduced young enough. So there's the whole domesticating the horse thing, for one thing.
Yeah. Now, horses were interesting because you can kind of understand why horses were domesticated. I mean, again, there's this very peculiar thing where someone said, I'm not going fast enough, but if I jump on the back of this creature, I can go fast enough.
I mean, I think that again is another variation on the whole I found an injured animal. I think probably what happened was that whoever was hunting the horse was hunting it for food and perhaps killed a nursing mother and noticed the foal nearby and perhaps felt sorry for it and kept the foal and raised it and
I mean that
they
it
became a
is
super
entirely
hunting team.
possible.
Yeah.
The interesting thing as well is that actually, animals changed society in a very, very dramatic way. In that, it even changed the fashion. I mean, we know where trousers came from. Trousers were introduced because of horse riding. Up until that point, across a lot of places, it would have been togas. It would have been, they're not skirts, but people would not have been wearing trousers, and they were literally designed for ease with horse riding.
I think that depends on the climate as well, though, because there's a fair bit of anthropological evidence that Cro-Magnon cave people during the winter months did wear something that was basically tunic and trousers, but it was, hide stitched together or tied together.
Yeah, definitely did have an impact on a great number of things. I mean, it had an impact on trade.
Yeah, definitely. And it also had an impact on things like agriculture. You can probably trace the grain revolution 10,000 years ago to it, which is probably one of the most harmful things that's ever happened to the human race. And then if
Yeah.
you add on to that the fact that we probably then started the industrialized farming of animals at around about the same time when we realized we could keep them and rear them ourselves. And
Yeah.
all sorts of things came from that. Did you know that almost every single disease that humans are prone to originated in cattle?
I would not be surprised.
In the keeping of cattle, and in the keeping of goats and things like that, and it's the fact of us living in close proximity to ungulates, basically. So things like syphilis, for example, originated in cattle. Chickenpox originated in cattle. Measles, cattle. Pretty much all the spotted diseases, smallpox, cattle. And it's not to say that necessarily that was all wrong, but there are definitely disadvantages to living with animals as well.
Yeah,
You could, I mean,
absolutely.
probably some of
Especially
the
during a period when you couldn't really disinfect and,
well, you didn't even know to, but yeah.
Exactly. It's very peculiar that no one ever said, let's ride cows. I mean, I'm sure that there definitely have been instances of people riding cows,
A
but
note of people riding yaks.
yes.
Slightly different. Yeah, I suppose you don't look at a cow and think, wow, what a majestic animal it is when it's running. I wish I could get in on that.
Yeah, but at the same time, you don't exactly look at camels and go, that's a majestic animal when it's running. If you've ever seen a camel run, it's like there's just a lot of limbs.
Well, the funny thing with
It
camels
kind of
is
just
they've got the two gaits, haven't they? Like giraffes. That's why giraffe in
Yeah.
Afrikaans is camel horse, where they move their left legs and then the right legs and the left legs and their right legs as if they're
Yeah.
bipeds, but they're not, which makes for a very
Yeah.
jerky gait.
It does make it for a very jerky gait. And then when they gallop, they just look so weird. The limbs just fly out. It's very bumpy and uncomfortable looking. And yeah. So, but again, I can understand camels. I can understand horses. But yeah, it is interesting that no one went, you know what? I'm gonna jump on the top of that cow. Well, I mean, people definitely did.
But obviously there's advantages to keeping animals as both food and also to harness their strength. Obviously we don't use cows for ploughing much anymore, or
No.
horses for drawing carts and things much anymore. Although they still did in parts of Dorset when my dad was growing up.
Yeah.
It was one of the last places to completely get rid of it and go the tractor route. There's a picture of my dad at 5 years old when he's been put on top of this massive, massive Shire horse, and he's not looking very happy at all.
My mother had exactly the same experience, and she was just put on top of these of the, one of these huge work horses when she was little, not being very happy about it. But Yeah, I mean, even in still in, I just remember visiting Ireland and approach. We were on a roundabout, and there was a sign that literally said, sort of saying, "No access for donkey and cart onto this road." And I thought, you have to have a sign for that, because there are still people using donkey and cart, apparently.
Okay. Two of the best signs I ever saw when I was out in South Africa, and one of them was, "Please do not remove tortoises from this area." Which, you know, coming from the UK is a bit sort of, why would you have a sign for that? But obviously it's an issue. And the other one was, "Please check under your car for penguins before driving away."
They might be trying to stow away with you.
Well, it was Boulder's beach, and penguins occasionally like to come in off the beach and get under something shady, like a car.
Yeah.
So they would come in and they'd get under your car, and you just find them nestled under your car in the car park.
Oh, that's kind of cute, actually. But yes, don't run over penguins. I can't believe we have to say that, but yeah. Now, to bring this back onto the sort of the speculative page, because we're just talking about animals in general now. Animals actually have obviously had a large impact, not on just on us socially, but also in the way that we tell stories.
Yeah, definitely.
And interestingly enough, when we look at general kind of mythos, from earlier times, animals are heralded both as gods and as enemies, but they're not really conjoined with humans in the same way that we then see in later fiction.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, so there's this separation. But there is also this hallowedness as well. And we see that across different cultures, where the gods were animals or animal-like or part animal. And the part animal, in particular, it's this odd combination between human and non-human, which we see a disturbing amount, actually. And I suppose Egypt is probably one of the best places to to start with when it comes to that.
Yeah. Yeah, an awful lot of the Egyptian gods are portrayed as having animal heads or in animal form.
Yes. But still oddly human, but not human at the same time.
Well, I mean, we won't go too much into Egyptian gods because I think we've talked about them before. But
yeah,
it is interesting. It is definitely what's representative. I mean, obviously we've talked about Sekhmet before, the lion-headed goddess of war and healing.
Two and very
Bast, surprising the goddess things. Of the cat-headed goddess of childbirth and silent death. and Sobek, the crocodile-headed goddess of treachery, I think it was.
Yeah, and then...
And something else. They were always patrons of something good and something bad at the same time.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, you look at sort of the first god, and then it kind of goes down, and then they start having kind of animal forms.
Yeah.
Also, sometimes they're green. That was quite odd. Horus and the bastard one whose name I've just forgotten.
Oh, do you mean Set?
Yes, Set, that's it. who is an anteater? I mean, what is Set? I mean, I know he's not an anteater, but
I don't think anyone really knows. I don't think the Egyptians really knew either. He's like, well, he's kind of like Anubis, but not kind of thing.
Yeah, he's not a jackal. But he's something. And again, we also see that across other cultures as well. It seems to be a consistent thing in mythos. But again, it really proves the kind of the separation between humans and animals, and yet the weird fascination with them. And the fact that animals were also heralded as natural forces, not just conveniences. I mean, we don't really see animals as natural forces in the way that they used to. And that included a lot of magic as well. And in particular, a lot of seasonal magic. If we fall back on Celtic, because it's just happens to be the easiest to talk about. We look at birds within Celtic mythos.
Yeah.
You know, the blackbird in particular, with its song, it was believed to have this link with the dead, in the world of the dead, to be able to pass through, and it kept secrets and things like that. I really like that mythos, actually.
Yeah.
And so animals weren't just something we were sharing the world with. They were an aspect of a larger part of magic and belief, which was respected, but was also feared. And yet, we tend to find that within different cultures, the animals which we eat stopped being revered very, very quickly, oddly enough. Can't imagine why.
Well, you don't eat your gods, really.
Yeah, you don't eat your gods.
Ultimately, that's bad practice.
Not a good idea. but it is kind of interesting that humans kind of changed their tune a tiny little bit. But obviously we don't know to what extent. We don't know whether there was a time in life when people did worship chickens. We don't know whether there was a time in life when people worshipped sheep. What we do know is that horses were always revered, and in most cultures, you don't eat horse even to this day. I mean, you still do in certain places, that's for sure. The French are guilty of it. And to be honest, I think if you're going to eat cows, you might as well be happy with eating horses. But it does still feel kind of, I'm having trouble speaking today. It does still feel kind of weird.
I suppose the thing is, we did used to eat horses, and then what happened was we found them to be useful, and they greatly increased our wealth and our ability to acquire things. Wealth in the terms of having free time, because free time, certainly back when we were living in caves, was the only real measure of wealth. Because that, if you had free time, that meant you'd already planned and gathered and stored enough to keep you through the winter months and the early spring months,
or
which is when the real
famine. Or it meant you were lazy and you'd be dying.
Or you would be dying, yeah. You wouldn't last very long. You certainly wouldn't be procreating to teach that attitude to your children. So I think we can just say safely that you would actually, you know, it was a symbol of your wealth to be able to have free time at all.
Yeah.
So yeah, we probably did eat horses right up until that point, and then it went on from there, I imagine.
So now I want to talk about cats. Now, we definitely worshipped cats in Egypt. I say we, like Jules and I were there. Jules might have been there. Were you there, Jules?
Old.
Cats are mystical and strange. Jules, you have a cat. I'm sure that you can explain further.
Well, she's not very mystical.
Is she not?
She's quite a mundane cat in many ways.
Aww.
Well, I know people like, I think actually having a cat cures you of the idea that they're mystical and strange, to be honest. And I've had a lot of cats. And yes, okay, cats can look elegant even when they're licking their asses, but ultimately they do some very stupid things and they look very silly when they're doing them. Cats absolutely hate to be laughed at as well.
Yeah, I bet they do.
It's interesting you should say that we worship them. Actually, we persecuted them over here in Britain.
Yeah.
And they were quite often burned alive as witches, whether they were with an accused witch or not. We also used them as house guardians, so we buried them alive inside walls when we were building houses.
Yeah.
Under hearthstones.
Now, that's an interesting thing, is that we thought of them as witches, but why did burying them in walls make us think that would protect the house?
Because they were petty spirits. So if you could trap the spirit, then it would have to guard the house because that's where its bones were.
Ah,
I think
okay.
Is the theory. We also used to do that to small children. So just to give everyone a full measure of just how gross we are as a species.
Okay.
In fact, the immurement of children in stone walls is well documented. And
so, yeah, we did. We still actually, there is a disturbing statistic about black cats even to this day, where black cats are the least likely to be adopted at shelters. And people still act violently to black cats, particularly around Halloween and things like that.
Yeah, it's the violence towards black cats is less over here in Britain, because in Britain it's good luck to have a black cat cross your path. In America, it's bad luck.
Yeah, but the thing is that may be the case within sort of people who know, but the American influence, there are a lot of people in Britain who do think that it's actually bad luck to have a cat, black cat, cross your path now. But yeah, even now within the UK, and I'm sure across in America, black cats are still tortured and killed, especially around the Halloween period, which I don't really get, because it's not like many people really believe in witches anymore. So why the prosecution of black cats?
I'm going to steer this conversation away slightly, because we're not really talking about animal companions now.
No, true. Sorry. I'm just getting upset about cats.
Yeah, let's move away from that. So certainly looking at the whole... If we just go back to the whole idea of actually having pets, because that's quite weird. I mean, we've talked about how sort of domestication probably came about and the practicalities of it and animals as gods. The modern practice of keeping pets... Is it because we need to keep a little bit of the wild, a little bit of nature somewhere that's controlled and safe? Because if you think about it, talking about cats specifically, they're one of the most... The domestic house cat is the most successful feline of all the species of felines. Yeah. It is also responsible for more episodes of extinction than almost any other animal.
Yes.
And... We've made that possible. I mean, they're successful because, unlike a lot of the other felines, they're incredibly adaptable. And what's really interesting about the house cat is the fact that they have learned... I think they've documented that dogs generally make about 500 or 600 different types of barks or noises.
Mm-hmm.
With cats, it's something closer to 12,000 different noises. Cats particularly know to do high cries that women, unfortunately, are genetically wired to respond to, because it's very similar to a baby crying.
Yeah.
Which is why we tend to be able to hear them a lot more easily, and why we tend to respond to them a lot more easily, whether we want to or not. So, yeah, they're quite clever, and it's not normal for a cat, if a cat's like in the wild or on its own, to just meow or make all these cries and trills and murts and things that cats do make. It's something that they sort of learn from living with us, and it's really interesting because they're silent predators. They depend entirely on stealth. They're not especially strong, most of them. They're not fast as certain other animals are. They kill by stealth, so obviously they're not going to meow at the bird they're creeping up on, because bird's not going to stay there. So the whole sort of the cat talk, and they will talk back to you. That's the funny thing. You'll talk to your cat and your cat will start trilling back to you, or meowing, or making that weird little murt noise it makes with its sort of tongue. It's very funny. So, I mean, that's really strange. But basically, that is a cat, that is an animal that is adapted to be the perfect predator for its niche. So it's really odd, in a way, if you think about it in those terms, to bring an animal like that in and make it your special pal. And I'm all for cats, obviously. But when you just think about it logically in those terms, that's an odd thing to do. Because when did we start doing that? I mean, people hypothesize that it was when cats started moving into the great big grain barns in Egypt. And that's when we started revering them, because they were killing the rats, etc.
Yeah. But
even so... that there's a leap there that hasn't quite been made.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't really explain everything. So,
because cats, socially, they have a very different role to dogs.
Yeah.
Like, you can understand bringing a dog. I mean, because dogs essentially would have started with hunting and protecting of the home. You know, that would have been a dog's role.
Yeah.
Cats, yeah, you have that... That, okay, they're going to kill the mice, so granaries and storage houses, they definitely would have liked having cats around. But nowadays, dogs have literally been bred to be faithful companions. Cats have not.
No, and as anyone who's ever trained a cat will understand, it's a case of you train a cat by convincing the cat that it is training you.
Yeah.
Because cats have no interest in pleasing you whatsoever. They're interested in pleasing themselves. It's that Irish saying.
Yes.
It's to please herself, the cat purrs. And if you want the cat to do something, it happens on the cat's terms. So you convince the cat that the cat is the one doing the training. Dogs different.
Yeah.
Dogs want to please you. So
yeah.
All that aside, that's a case of that's real time, real life animal companions. Why would we do that? I don't know. I don't have an answer. But it's certainly reflected in literature and film. And animals are a great way of keeping kids on board with a story, particularly.
Yeah.
Animals and children tend to go together quite well.
Yes. Now, why is that?
I suppose in storytelling terms, it's if you look at children's picture books, for example, a good way of delivering quite difficult concepts to young children is by making it one remove from a human. So, for example, I'm going to say talk about Goodnight Mog. Goodnight Mog is one of Judith Kerr's Mog books, strangely enough. And it's the one where Mog dies.
Mm.
And it's basically an entire picture book, beautifully written, exquisitely illustrated, about dying and grief and losing a family member. And it's accessible for very, very young children who don't really understand what death is yet, because it's Mog that dies, and Mog
yeah.
isn't human. So the sympathy's there because they love Mog.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's not as paralysing as literally seeing a family member of the same species die would be.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. And it's the same, I think, you go up the grades a little bit. If you go to sort of the older junior fiction books where I don't think Redwall is quite as popular as it was when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
But they're war stories. They're stories of conquest and war and good versus evil. And the reason they get away with some of the really gruesome, gory scenes in those books is because Brian Jacks has made all the characters animals.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's similar with things like Wind in the Willows. Because if you think about it, Wind in the Willows, well, it's charming, also has some quite difficult adult concepts in it, like finding out where your home really is, finding out where you really belong, having
yeah.
everything taken away from you, going to prison for a crime that you committed, being being prejudiced against
yeah.
someone, and also being discriminated against for not being like everybody else. And I don't think Kenneth Grahame necessarily deliberately put all of these concepts in there, but they're definitely there. And you get
yeah.
away with it because all the main characters are animals, living side by side with humans and dressing like humans and eating the same food as humans as well, which is really bizarre.
It is true that using animals for storytelling is a great way of talking about tragedy specifically. And as you said, with Mog, I don't know, that's actually genuinely making me very sad just thinking about
it. It's
that.
A really sad book. It's a very upset. It's a lovely book, but it's very upsetting. It's almost as upsetting as the book called Nothing, but, you know, I won't go into that one.
But even certainly with me, when I, well, you've obviously read it. I've written a children's book, which at the moment is referred to as Anise Starr and the Empress Paintbrush. And there are actually quite a few animal companions within that.
Just a few.
Just a few. Namely, we have Wolf, who is a dog, and we have Huynh, who is a fox. And then we have Fidget, who is a teacup. That's not an animal, but, you know. It's
what
kind
species
of, on the same...
of animal is that? Ah, well, that is Porcelanus officinalis.
It's a real thing now. Jules put Latin.
He may be found roaming the wild cupboards of the abandoned kitchen.
Which is actually, oddly enough, where you'll find the teacup, who can move and is quite animal-like. If Fidget were an animal, Fidget would probably be a mouse or a stoat, perhaps. So there you go. And then obviously we have the magpies and things like that. And they represent something which is actually quite sad, because all of those characters are actually dead in one form or another.
Yeah.
Because they are deities, and to become a deity you have to have died first. And there is a tragedy with that, which trying to write with kind of human characters would have been quite difficult. And even with the human-esque characters that I have that are deities, whether consciously or not, I don't know why I decided to do this, but I've removed a lot of the human element within them, because it makes them separate, it makes them strange, and it actually makes the topic and the subject easier to approach.
Yeah. But then you can look at, obviously, animals turn up in, I'm not going to say more traditional, I was going to say more traditional, but I don't mean more traditional, I mean sort of older, slightly fustier children's literature. Please don't take that the wrong way. Yep. So if you look at things like the Chronicles of Narnia, there are the talking beasts, and they're very separate. They are animal, but they've got more human characteristics.
Yeah.
And obviously, Aslan himself has made them that way. The talking beasts are very... are the real, I suppose, denizens of Narnia. Humans are supposed to be there and rule over them.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit disturbing when you think about it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the talking beasts always show up in these stories to act as guides and companions. The one that always springs to mind is Reepy Cheep, the mouse, who's a little mouse in a cavalier's hat and boots sword.
Yeah.
And he's... you know, big, you know, he's about the size of a small child, because, you know, the small animals got slightly bigger and the big animals got slightly smaller generally. He's just a real scrapper, and he's kind of like Sir Didymus out of Labyrinth, whereas he'll throw himself into battle. Nothing matters except his honour. And he is cute, but at the same time he represents something that's a bit hard to pin down, really. Something that perhaps isn't terribly wise.
Yeah.
You don't expect Reepy Cheep to be especially clever, in a way. He's just throwing him... and I suppose that's the same with all the animals, all the talking beasts, is that they will act first on their animal instinct and only really think and reason like we would expect a human to later.
Yeah. But I think the other element is the fact that in order to care for them... in order to sort of recognize that these animals have sentience, they have been given these human-like qualities.
Yeah, speech, for example.
Yeah, speech being the big one. In that suddenly we care a lot more about them because they can speak in a language which we understand.
Yeah, whereas if you then go to, say, some of the animals in Lord of the Rings, Shadowfax is a good one. He's basically the king of horses, and obviously he doesn't get a speaking part. He's just an extremely swift sort of horse god, almost, but very much still a horse. And perhaps then if you also look at things like the animals and A Little White Horse, which is somewhere between the two, so you've got Wolf in that, who actually is a lion, although they say he's a dog, so it doesn't alarm people. Which is hilarious, that the idea that a girl in Victorian England might believe that a dog and a lion were that similar. There's the Little White Horse itself, which is actually a unicorn. And then there's a whole host of other animals. There's Wiggins, who's the King Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, and is basically vanity personified. there's Serena the Hare, who's just calm and sort of loyally follows Maria everywhere after Maria rescues her from a trap.
Yeah.
There's Zachariah, who is a massive, massive black tomcat, who's normally partnering crime with the dwarf who cooks in the kitchen. You can tell this book is just sounds like it's completely bonkers, but it is the perfect sort of rewritten, perfect sort of original fairy tale in a way.
Yeah.
And there's one more. Who am I missing?
I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe I've named them all now. Oh, no. There's Periwinkle, who is a fat grey pony.
Yay!
But all the animals are portrayed, and you normally see them through Maria's point of view, in fairness, but all the animals are portrayed as being slightly more human in their intelligence and being actually slightly more sensible than the humans. Knowing what's going on and all working to solve this curse that's overlaid the Valley of Moonacre for hundreds of years. Except that, and you know, you get the impression that if it had been left to the animals would have solved it in 5 seconds flat when it first happened.
Naturally.
But the stupid humans keep getting in the way. They have to work with such inferior humans. It's not until Maria comes along that they manage to get things working. Which was a nice touch, I thought.
Yeah, that is quite a nice touch.
But again, it's obviously a children's book, and it was a good way of getting children invested in the idea of morality and the fact that just because you have power, that doesn't actually make you right when you do something.
Yeah.
And then there's Disney. Have you ever seen a Disney film where there wasn't at least one or two little tweeting birds or little creatures, squirrels or mice or, you know, a long-suffering horse or something in there somewhere?
There's always the animal companion. Always. And again, the animal companions within those all have relatively human characteristics, and they all have a basic understanding of the plot, of the things which are happening on, and are invested in helping the main character.
Yeah, very definitely. And I suppose now, it's more obvious than in some than in others, isn't it? But
well, I'm just trying to think. In fact, there's only one Disney film I can think of right now where the animal companion is not the animal companion, which goes throughout the story, doesn't really understand what's going on, and that's Moana with Hey the chicken.
Yeah, and that is a very stupid chicken, but you're kind of invested in that chicken.
Superbly stupid chicken. She has the pig as well, and the pig seems to understand basic things. Like, the pig seems to be encouraging her to get on the boat and stuff like that, and seems to genuinely understand stuff, but the pig isn't with her for the entirety of the story. The bird is. And the bird is incredibly stupid. But still seems to have a basic kind of understanding. Still seems to have a basic kind of goodwill toward Moana, if that makes sense. But other than that, I think most Disney films have got at least one animal with a human understanding of what is going on and an investment to make things work for the main character. So you have the tiger in Aladdin. You have Sven in Frozen. Entangled, you have Maximus the horse.
Yep.
In El Dorado, The Road to El Dorado, again, that's not Disney, that's DreamWorks. But you have the horse as well. Altivo, I think his name is.
Do you know, I've never seen that film.
What?
I don't know, I just missed it, so I've never seen it.
What? Jules, oh my god. Oh my, how have you... I'm so disappointed in you.
I've never seen Lilo and Stitch either, in fairness.
Oh my god, Jules! Seriously? Okay, I can't get angry, considering that there are so many books that you've read that I haven't even, that I don't even know exist. But, like, seriously, we need to change that. The Road to El Dorado is... You know what? Never mind. trying to think of other Disney films as well. I'm trying to find the exception that proves the rule.
I don't think there really is one. I mean, you could argue that some of the early ones, the animals are less conscious. Like in Snow White, the animals just come in out of the forest to help her, and it's kind of a symbol of her purity.
Yeah, but the animals, but again, still have an element of consciousness. Like that, when they're trying to clear up, they're about to sort of mop things under the rug, and she goes, And they go, all right. Is it like they're clear? This is a human understanding of consciousness. The fact that also the animals seem to be able to use basic household utensils. These are very human qualities. And animals will be faithful. And I'm not saying animals aren't intelligent, but they're not intelligent in the same manner that they are portrayed in Disney films. And yet you cannot find a single film which doesn't include at least one animal companion with these human qualities.
Yeah, they're essential. And a part of that obviously was, you know, whatever else you can say about Disney, and you can say a lot of negative stuff, but he was an absolute animal lover.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that was carried on by his son, obviously, when his son took over. And
yeah,
he actually, I think, was recorded as saying that there will always be animals in the films. He made so many nature films as well.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I mean, they're a bit inaccurate and a bit dry now, but he just had a real fascination for nature and animals as well, so there was always going to be animals in his films. I mean, his live action films, live action sounds wrong, but there's the Three Lives of Thomasina Tabby Cat, for example. There's the cat that came from outer space. There's that darn cat. I mean, he had a thing about cats as well.
Clearly he did. He would have approved of my cat-only episode. Yes.
So, I mean, generally, you know, animals turned up in films that he was involved in because that's what he was interested in. So,
yeah,
in a sort of not quite as Disney fashion, obviously, just a brief mention, Tamora Pierce has animals in pretty much all her books as well. And maybe it's like an animal lover thing. It's something I feel I haven't done very much, as in it hasn't been practical to put animals in, but I've absolutely wanted to.
Yeah.
It's like I've managed to like wangle a greyhound in there somewhere. But, you know, it hasn't been practical for the story or for storytelling to put animals in there.
Yeah.
But it's something I absolutely would like to do in future, so maybe that's something that will happen in future books. A final one probably that's good to look at before we examine exactly why animal companions are so important is where part of the character is reflected as an animal, and that's Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials.
Yeah.
So Northern Lights, or The Golden Compass if you live in America, The Subtle Knife, and The Amber Spyglass. Every human has a demon, and the demon is literally part of the human soul. Generally, it's the opposite gender to the human, though not always. And it generally takes the form of an animal, and it represents part of the human that is generally hidden. It's hidden in our world.
Yeah.
But in their world, someone else can see it.
Yeah.
So, for example, I mean, your demon doesn't settle until you hit puberty as well.
Yeah.
In this world. So who you're going to be and what the deepest core part of you, what shape it takes, is not settled until you've hit puberty, basically, until you've grown up.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's quite interesting. And I read those books the first time, and I got to the end and I just had the worst book hangover. And I obviously passionately wanted a demon.
Yes.
And I've spoken to a lot of people who felt that way. You know, having something that was kind of, it's part of you, but it's separate.
Yeah.
And you're never really alone with it. And it's an animal as well.
Mm.
They mentioned some of the masters of Jordan College having had demons that were not, in fact, animals. One of them had a beautiful woman as a demon, which I think I would have found quite disconcerting.
Yeah.
And that's less appealing to me than having, say, a wolf or a cat or, you know, an ermine or something like that.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I would have wanted a trout or something like that either.
Yeah, that could have been quite difficult, actually.
But I think, really, that kind of what Pullman has done there is reflected what all books that have animal companions has actually been doing, which is that the animals reflect a better part of the character that sometimes they cannot access consciously themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And the interesting thing is that actually this is not a new concept in some ways. And the relationship between animals and humans Well, people always say that you resemble your pets in some way or another.
You come
I'm
to
not sure how much
your
truth
pets.
how true that is, but I do definitely think that the kind of pet that you're going to choose is going to be a sort of a bit of a reflection of the kind of person that you are. Now, some people have lots and lots of different pets, so I'm not sure how true that is, but I do think that there is an element to it as well. Which is that if you're a quiet introverted type, you might prefer a cat to a dog. Simply because the requirements that one needs if one has a dog do require a certain amount of socialization. Again, I'm being general. This is not the one and only way. I'm just being very, very general.
I don't know, actually. I think if you require more company but don't necessarily want it to be from other humans, you go for a dog.
Yeah,
because a
this
dog
is true.
Requires more physical a dog actually really kind of needs you there, whereas a cat will at least affect not to need you.
Yeah,
and a cat's happy sleeping 18 hours a day just not paying any attention to you until it wants you, and then it really wants you
for food and pats.
Sometimes it's just a case of it's a little control thing with cats.
It
is just a case of I want to know that when I ask, you're there.
Yeah.
It's like having a really, really demanding girlfriend for about 5 minutes of a day. it's nice sometimes for the cat to sort of stroll out and say, actually, I do kind of like you, and I want to do the whole bonding thing where I just rub up against you and make you smell like me.
So that you can never cheat on me with another cat.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
This morning, in a very Disney-esque manoeuvre, I opened the bedroom curtains, looked out, and there was a little ginger cat in the garden, and it walked over to the window and started meowing up at me. This is the little ginger cat that Alan has befriended. So I said to Alan, oh, look, your little mate's out there. He's like, oh. So he ran out into the garden to go and see this cat. And it was like two long-lost friends who haven't seen each other for years running across a field towards each other.
Aww!
And so I went out as well. And
it was deeply envious.
It's a very, very cute cat. It's not our cat at all. We don't know whose it is, but it likes our garden. It's quite fond of Alan. It quite likes me too. Dexter, on the other hand, does not like this at all.
I'm sure Dexter doesn't. For all those confused, Dexter is Jules's cat, not just a prisoner she's keeping in the house.
No, I wouldn't give those names on a podcast. I mean, I don't have prisoners.
Smart. Good save. Right. Well, it's time for us to say goodbye, but before we do, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation. Now, I was going to suggest something entirely different, but after the shock of today, my recommendation is The Road to El Dorado.
Okay. That's not exactly recent.
It isn't a recent film, no, so I am cheating a little bit, but I'm going to say The Road to El Dorado because it's just a classic. It's one of my favourite films of all time. I can still quote very large amounts of it, which I often do. So I am genuinely shocked that there's anyone in the world who hasn't seen it. Anyone in the English-speaking world who hasn't seen it. So if you haven't seen The Road to El Dorado, I do very much recommend it. Definitely worth the watch. And if you haven't seen it and then you watch it, please do message me and share your thoughts, because I'm always open to talking about this very, very good film. And on that note, guys, we'll catch up with you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.